Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the second quarter wrap-up, and of course, one of the juiciest, most special times is News, Trends, and Stories with the great man, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell, and he's with us today. Joseph, it's just great to be on the phone with you.
Thanks for having me back, Catherine. It's been, you know, I feel this quarter a little bit like the comedian Joan Rivers, you know, can we talk?
Well, you know, I was bopping all over Asia, and I kept having this urge to call you and say, did you just see that? Anyway, so it's always, you know, I mean, too, it's wonderful to have you by our side when we talk about News, Trends, and Stories, because you have such fantastic insight into things, but second of all, you have the integrity to be outraged. You know, and we've never needed that outrage more.
Well, thanks. I knew that Irish temper I inherited from my father would pay off someday.
This is unacceptable. Okay.
Right.
Well, that normally we go through the different sections of News, Trends, and Stories. This is part one. And in part one, we're going to do economy and financial markets and then geopolitics as we normally do. But first, we've added a section at your recommendation called long-term trends, because there is so much entertainment, distraction, and noise in the news that it's, to me, it's invaluable to keep bringing people back to the long-term trends. We also added a section to the Soleri Report called Soleri Core Concepts, which are concepts that we talk about a lot with News, Trends, and Stories, like entrainment or control files, and, you know, has more background on different terms that we use that could help people. So we'll talk about long-term trends first, then economy and financial markets, then geopolitics. And last quarter, we had you and I put together a report card for the Trump administration. It was very popular. So we decided we were going to update it, and we'll end geopolitics with the Trump report card. So we have plenty to cover. At the web presentation, for those listening, we have in the web presentation a page called Long-Term Trends, and it might help you to track along. And we've got some great links for all of these different concepts. So this is revisiting, and the point of this is to make sure as we do go through the tremendous number of events in the second quarter so that you see those long-term trends, because that's where you get actionable intelligence. And we're really seeking actionable intelligence here. Okay, so I'm just going to dive in, Joseph. The first item, of course, is space. Here we go. And you and I, and you have wonderful coverage of what's happening in space in Giza Dex Star. It's one of my favorite places to go to your website to see your latest. But clearly, you know, we are committed as a global civilization to become a multiplanetary civilization. It's absolutely happening. Any comments you want to make on space? Here we go, because this is a long live trend and it's clearly underway.
Well, yeah, there are some developments that happened just this quarter that I think people need to be aware of. Two in particular that caught my eye were, first of all, the Chinese have continued their experimentations with quantum entanglement communications. They have now successfully been able to use that phenomenon to entangle information now at a distance of over 1,000 kilometers, to be about 600 miles. And this was done, incidentally, in a ground-to-satellite link. Now, clearly, to me, Catherine, what that indicates is that they're taking all of the necessary proof-of-concept experimental steps to put into place a global satellite system that is going to rely on that phenomenon for the transmission of data. And it's, as electronic systems go, it's a fairly secure system. So in other words, it looks to me like we're watching the long-term build-out of the financial clearing system that they need in order to make their One Belt, One Road project work. Clearly, the Chinese are thinking in terms of that project, particularly in Central Asia and on into Europe. They're thinking in terms of not simply a ground-based infrastructure to handle it, but they're also thinking in terms of an international financial clearing system that will be secure and trustworthy and so on and so forth. That's the first thing I've noticed. And the second thing that I think is very interesting that we've seen as a development, kind of the way the news reports this is, of course, that these are kind of disentangled stories, but I think they're very much related, and that was Russia's move recently to start introducing blockchain currencies, you know, electronic right. currencies like Bitcoin. I think that's part and parcel of the same project. I think what you see really is Russia has decided to follow one avenue and do the necessary work to get one aspect of that system put into place, and China's doing another avenue. So in other words, they're coordinating their efforts, although the way the news is presenting it, it doesn't look coordinated, but that's the way it looks to me.
Well, if you look at what has happened with the Chinese in the second quarter, when I was in Hong Kong, the MSCI index announced after several attempts that they weren't going to include next year, mm-hmm. starting next year, the A shares in China. You mm-hmm. know, until that happens next year, it was only the shares trading on the American or Hong Kong exchange that were included in that index. So that is a huge step in building out liquidity for their global yes. equity securities. And then they've now approved bond investors coming into their markets in China. And along with going into the SDR system, what you're seeing is the build-out of global liquidity around their securities and currency. And a global satellite system is essential. Now, they don't, only Russia and the United States have those global systems now, but China's pushing for it. And with quantum computing, I would think it would be highly secure. So these are very, very big steps to building out the global liquidity they need to compete on an international stage.
Yep, absolutely.
Although it's interesting, when I was in Hong Kong, the big beef was you couldn't trust them to keep contracts. You couldn't trust the Chinese culture, the PRC culture, to keep contracts. And all of Hong Kong is very nervous about what's going to happen after this 20th anniversary celebration. So, you know, you're seeing the same tendencies of the pro-centralization team to sort of kill the goose that laid the golden egg. There is here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, second trend is the financial coup d'etat, including the black budget and the hidden system of finance. And I continue to think that the financial coup continues. But why don't you say any thoughts you have on the financial coup?
Well, I think it's continuing. And I think not only is it continuing, but I am getting increasingly, Catherine, the intuition and suspicion that we are watching the manifestation of another aspect of this hidden system financial coup d'etat that we haven't discussed in that connection previously. And I want to mention something that I mentioned just before we started the recording. It has a bit to do with what you also have put in your outline under Global 2.0 to 3.0. You had a book review, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, and then under Decentralization, Can We Relocalize? There's something that disturbs me, and we've discussed this, kind of touched on it previously in these wrap-ups. This is the increasingly distant relationship, or the increased disconnect, I should say, between the major financial markets and actual human market activity. And what I'm referring to is just within the last 3 to 4 days, I think it is, we have seen yet another flash crash occur on the NASDAQ in this country. And, of course, these things, to my mind, Catherine, are the implications of having all these dark pools, these high-frequency trading algorithms and computers doing now the bulk of trading, not only on the equities markets, but also on the commodities markets and so on and so forth. And what this means to me is if you have a bunch of machines trading, then increasingly that activity is going to be disconnected from real reflection of actual human market conditions. And the problem here is that these markets are also very big centralized markets. In other words, they're not reflecting say, what's going on in Perth, Australia, or Bangkok, Thailand, or anything like that. They're not reflective of actual regional or local conditions. And this frightens me, because I think part of the problem, as you've been pointing out, is we need to relocalize. And
right.
These high-frequency trading pools are just not going to allow this to happen. In fact,
right.
The problem is they're creating a condition which, to me, I don't know, what it looks like to you, but to me, it looks like if you're trying to perform risk analysis or, do financial statement analysis of companies that you may want to invest in, and you get this kind of activity on the stock market that is not reflective of any of that, but really more reflective of computer-generated speculation in equities or commodities or what have you. Again, you're not getting any real market representation. It's becoming increasingly difficult to calculate. Is this...
Well, it's worse than that, because you're getting swings in both the cost of capital and different
right.
securities that is like a tornado, and it's wreaking havoc in the real economy.
Yes.
So, in June, on June 15th, Fortune published a review of the Fortune 500, and it showed a chart, Joseph, that I wanted to tell you about it, starting in 1955 and
mm-hmm.
until 1995. So for 40 years, the GDP of the U.S. And the valuation of, or the Fortune 500 revenues
mm-hmm.
sort of moved up together. They were almost in perfect alignment. And then the World Trade Organization goes into effect in 1995, and the financial coup begins with money disappearing from the federal government. And suddenly, the Fortune 500 revenues explode. And as of 2017, the GDP is up 4,600%, but the Fortune 500 revenues are up 9,000%. And that is a giant sucking sound.
Yes, it
of
is.
Of every...
course.
Every ounce of economic value from the real economy into this, the planet equity. And, some of that is legitimate stuff and some of it's not. It's our old friend, the highly levered company coming in with a high PE and sucking up all the market share locally in
yep.
a way that shrinks the total pie.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And, this is a computer-generated casino. And the thing about these flash crashes, the other thing that I think that I need to mention here is I have this strong suspicion, and it's been increasing every time I see these flash crashes occur, that what you're looking at is a system that may be showing all the signs of an artificial intelligence, because increasingly the quants, the people that have designed and run these high-frequency trading dark pools, even they admit they no longer really know what's going on. So to me, that's kind of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying, well, the system has woken up and it's driving itself. So to me, this changes the investment culture, and this is what I think you've said so many times about decentralization. Can we relocalize? And I think increasingly people are going to have to be aware of, if they're investing in some project locally
right.
or regionally, they're going to have to be aware of to what extent is a company or partnership that they might be considering going into business with, to what extent is that group or company exposed to these national markets that are so manipulable and manipulated by these computerized trading systems. I think that's going to be, like you say, the great sucking sound, and that's the way they're going to try and suck even more wealth out locally. So that's a strategy
right.
I think that we're going to increasingly have to be aware of.
Right. Well, that's the war on cash.
That's the war on cash. Precisely.
That's pushing the war on cash. The thing that concerns me is there was an excellent article in The Economist about 6 months ago called In Retreat, about the fact that multinational companies had steadily dropping margins and were getting a lot more competition locally all over the world, including in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and their revenues are falling. And in fact, if you look at this Fortune 500 chart for about a year or two, sure enough, revenues are falling. And this is happening in combination with what you and I have talked about at the end of the debt growth model. Mm-hmm. And Cynthia McKinney and I talked about it, and it's in the little video we put up for the second quarter wrap-up this week, where we said, you know, the problem is now you've got all these rich criminal slugs, and now that things are shrinking, you know, the game is sort of winding down, you know, they're fighting over the pie, and the pie is shrinking, and it's turning mean. And to me, the big danger here is war, because I think one of the reasons the press for a bigger military budget and the press for war is they see war as the only way to compete back into the game.
Right. And that's all the more reason, again, that people with money to invest and time to invest need to start thinking in local and regional terms.
Right.
And to be very careful about with whom they're dealing with.
Right,
and, you know,
right.
We've seen another trend on this centralization thing this quarter with Amazon, of course, buying Whole Foods. And I know that food is a major part of not only geopolitical thinking, but of your thinking. And, you know, Catherine, I hate to say it, you know, because I'm pretty much a kind of a libertarian sort of thinker when it comes to markets. But, yeah, with these companies getting so big with this Internet of Things, I think it's high time, and particularly Amazon and the so-called media corporations, I think it's high time we start considering, again, the idea of trust busting, because these...
Right. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, these things are becoming too big. They're becoming too powerful. When you get a company that is plugged into the CIA now, you know, plugged into organic foods and retailing, there's something wrong here. There's really no connect between selling books and selling groceries here. So, you know.
Well, let me give you a little tidbit. 90% of Amazon's Prime customers, you know, the sort of membership club where you pay a fee and then you get all sorts of benefits, that 90% of Amazon Prime customers are within 10 miles of a Whole Foods in the United States, right? So imagine what's going to happen. And, of course, you know, the CIA has a $600,000 a year contract to plug the Amazon cloud into all the intelligence agencies. So you can imagine, you know, whether it's control of food or control of the database, this is a very frightening thing. And I'll tell you what frightens me the most. That when I was in Asia, I heard a presentation that Jack Ma gave. I think it was when he came down to the Pearl River Delta, you know, when they're going through the big planning exercise for the whole area down there in the south. And he basically said, you know, robotics and artificial intelligence are very dangerous, and that's why we at Alibaba have to convert them into tools that can make small business more successful and stronger.
Yes.
And if you look at the Alibaba model, it's basically designed to support and create a platform for small business, whereas Amazon is much more designed to take business away from small business. And I think the Alibaba model, you know, give it another 20 years and they're going to slaughter Amazon.
Yeah, I do too over time. You know, I commented to you when you first told me about that story that I sure could use a robot, you know, to do my dishes and wash my clothes, you know, so that I have more time, you know, to work with the website and to research and write the book. So yeah, I think that model is a decent model. The thing that people again are going to have to watch out for is the extent to which any robotic technology
right.
like that is plugged into the major centralizing systems.
Well, we skipped ahead. We started with space. Here we go. We went to the financial coup d'etat, and then we, without me mentioning, the third trend is planet equity and planet debt. We talked about that, and you brought up Global 2.0, which is sort of our expression for shifting the money out of the industrial economy and into the networked economy, often by illegal means, including the financial coup d'etat.
Yep.
And then strategic importance of food and water, which one of the things that frustrates me tremendously is I'm constantly lobbied for about digital currencies and cryptocurrencies. And
yep.
while the smart money is locking up the entire food supply, you know, they've got a tremendous number of our smartest people chasing zeros and ones, you know, in digital world. And I just find it mind-boggling.
Well, I do too. And again, you know, it's an example of this strategy of getting people to think in terms of investment into the centralizing model. And, you know, as far as I can tell, Catherine, these blockchain digital ones and zeros things that they want people to invest in, that to me, again, has, like you, I think it's a big Ponzi scheme. People need to be looking at investment opportunities where in their area, in their region, you know, where they can invest in something where people are actually making something. I don't care what it is, an art gallery, you know, an auto mechanic shop, whatever. Where something is actually being accomplished.
Well, the one reason I do think it's important we all learn blockchain and understand what it means is because you've got 8 billion people growing globally who want to transact with each other, but they can't because the transaction fees are too high. And if my understanding of blockchain is correct, it has the ability to bring those transaction fees way, way down.
Right.
So that's the, you know, the legitimate side of it. I want to jump to the something that you and I talk a lot about and are going to be talking about today a fair amount, and that is the U.S. federal budget, because a lot of the U.S. and the global economy basically work off of both the spending, the credit, the contracts. You know, it's a big piece of the global pie, and it holds up the fixed income and derivatives markets. And we've been kicking the can on the federal budget for many decades, and particularly through the bailouts. And now, as I said in the annual wrap-up in January, we're at a runway. And so now we're talking about controlled demolitions. And we're watching the Trump administration sort of break down over the fiscal cliff. You know, a lot of what they want to do, they're running smack into all the budgetary issues. And so... Our next trend is America goes over the fiscal cliff, and there's no doubt about it that we're starting to hit the wall.
Right. Well, it's not just America. This is something that we're watching happen in Europe as well.
Right.
Italy just bailed out the Banco Monte Paschi di Siena, which I don't know if people know the significance of that bank. It's the world's oldest bank that has been in continuous operation since the Renaissance. So, you know, this is a very significant thing. And at the heart of this, Catherine, and I think at the heart, as you've mentioned, with the federal budget here, we're looking at something that has, as you say, the can was kicked down the road, but now we're going to have to deal with it. At the center of all of this is this big, huge pile of derivatives that is still there. No one really knows what to do with it. And you had an article, I think, in this quarterly wrap-up that I think is very, very significant, and that's the way Japan has been handling this.
Right.
They have actually literally been writing off their debt. In other words, it's kind of a Japanese version of debt jubilee. And I think increasingly, mm-hmm. Catherine, that's going to have to be something that people talk about. But here's the hook in this problem. I think any discussion of it without a discussion, as you've been emphasizing over and over again for as long as I've been familiar with your work, is that the central banking welfare warfare model, which is at the heart of it, has to be challenged.
Right.
We have to start looking at this, and we have to start, I think, as a matter of strategic necessity, we have to start targeting the families that have been behind it, the Warburgs, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, DuPonts, the Italian banking families, Turnentaxis, you know, all of it. We have to zero in on these people and begin exposing this whole model, because it, over time, is simply not working, and left to their own devices, as Clinton let them do during his administration, we see the result. So something has to be done. I think any discussion of debt jubilees without a discussion of the model that led to them in the first place is...
Right, exactly. It doesn't work. Right. The model is the problem.
Yeah, the model's the problem. And, you know, I talked about this whole thing in way back in Babylon's Banksters. You actually had the same situation developing in Mesopotamia, you know, thousands of years ago. And they would have regular jubilees, cycles of jubilees, where they simply would erase all private debt. It was just simply wiped off the books. And everybody would start again, you know. So they never addressed the central problem, and this is what we're faced with now.
Right. wash, rinse, repeat.
Yes, wash, rinse, repeat, exactly.
So one of the chilling moments, you've heard me off and on for the last 6 months. I've been yapping a lot about Chicago. And, yes. Of course, a couple weeks ago, I got an email from Harry Blazer, who was in Chicago, and he said, there's a homeless person every 100 to 500, or 100 to 300 yards. Yes. And I've been watching sort of who and what has been organized in Chicago. And then, of course, we saw the Illinois Treasurer come out last week with a YouTube video basically saying, look, the state has now over $800 million in late penalty fees just on its existing receivables. And, you know, we're now Moody's is threatening to downgrade them to junk, even though they did came up with a budget by voting a 32% increase in the income tax. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
But I started to take a look because I've been very concerned that Home and Square was a version of a local rendition center, and that organ harvesting and other really dirty organized crime games have been going on. So I came back to you last week and I said, you know, Joseph, it looks to me like all the firms and people who made money on the rape of Russia.
Yep.
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 Yep. Because
look, I think you're looking here at something that has spun off from what we've been talking about for several years, this hidden system of finance that I think was put into place after World War II. In other words, they set this thing up, Catherine, ostensibly to finance covert operations and secret black projects research. But given the corruption that such a system will inevitably engender, I think it's now spread to just purely criminal activity, such as you suggested, organ harvesting,
right,
slavery rings, you know, pedophilia,
right,
rings, the whole nine yards. And they've coupled that, as you've rightly pointed out, with the whole idea of control files, of getting information on people. I think you're looking at a huge underground economy here. And Chicago is just the tip of the iceberg. I think this is a
right,
truly global network.
Well, the thing that worries me about Chicago is it looks like they're coming into a big,
yep,
you know, a big privatization. If you have a real collapse of the rating and the state and local government in Chicago, then I think those networks are going to pick up a lot of businesses and market,
yep,
share and real estate cheap. And they don't care if their real estate goes down to zero if they can double their holdings.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about that. Okay, global productivity. One of the things that is very important when you're in the investment world or government leadership world is watching productivity. And a lot of the economic blessings that have come in the G7 nations have come from steadily increasing productivity. And now we've seen productivity stall. And
right,
I've written a lot about why I think that. Last year in the second quarter wrap-up, we wrote something called Productivity, Prosperity, and Popsicle Index, which basically said, you know, this giant sucking sound of Fortune 500 revenues growing, you know, at double the rate of the GDP is wreaking havoc in the real economy, and it's destroying productivity. It's not increasing it. So, you know, if corporate growth comes by destroying government productivity and causing government money to be used in a negative return on investment, of course it's going to destroy productivity. And I do think that the Trump election was a productivity backlash in the heartland from people who have to work with the concrete, you know, the oil and gas, the food, the trucking, the, you know, so the concrete world was pushing back about that. But I don't think I don't think we see any overall understanding of this issue. The reality, though, Joseph, if you look at what's happening with productivity, it's going to be very painful economic if the trends continue.
It is, and this is something that, again, I think people really have to latch on to, what you're saying here, because the current corporate model is simply acquisitions and mergers. It's not producing anything. And just as in Illinois, what you're suggesting is that they're collapsing things simply so that they can pick up hard assets for pennies on the dollar. And the problem here is people, I think, have been confused, and I think it's been, to a certain extent, a deliberate confusion on the part of the powers that be.
Right.
Between finance capital and equity capital. because what we're watching is the finance capital part of the equation just going bonkers with greed and corruption and a regulatory climate that is basically non-existent, while at the same time they have slapped all sorts of regulation on the actually productive part of the economy. And this cannot continue because, you know, the end of finance capital run amok is socialism and communism. This is always the way it works. And I know that sounds strange to most people, but it isn't. What I think really is at the root of this, Catherine, is it's, again, a cultural phenomenon.
Right.
Because we have a corporate climate in which virtue does not exist.
Right.
So, you know, my advice to Mr. Trump is it's nice to want to make America great again, but it's much more important to make America good again.
Right.
Because when you do not have a virtuous culture, when you don't have any cultural traditions or values at all, everything collapses economically.
Right. Right.
This is central.
We can't afford the corruption and the warfare. It's too expensive.
Exactly.
It's just it's killing. Yeah, it's killing the fundamental. It's killing the goose that laid the golden egg. Okay,
yep.
Next trend is shift to the multipolar world. I just got back to, you know, when I decided I wanted to write about how we're going to enforce the Constitution, I said, you know, I've got to talk to Cynthia, because Cynthia McKinney is one of the few Congress people who really has integrity in terms of her intent and goals. But she has, you know, she served for 12 years. She ran lots of campaigns. She won the Senate primary, but you know, got dirty tricked out of it. But she's got very deep experience right in the machinery. I was a political appointee. I wasn't an elected official. So I said, I just need her big brain and her knowledge. And so she's teaching political science in Bangladesh. So I got on a plane. I asked her, can I come over for a week and talk? No, it took a week. It took a week of just talking about the nuts and bolts of what do we do? How do we do it? You know, what's involved? What are the important issues? And, you know, to me, the big issue was slug management. How do you take care of the slugs? And how do you free people from being controlled by the slugs and the control files? So we just had a week, but she is surrounded by these incredible students. She teaches at a university where you've just got the creme de la creme of these young kids from Bangladesh who are just, Joseph, they're so intelligent, they're so energized, they're so excited about the future, and what they're excited about is helping the Bengali people. They see an opportunity to build the pie, but you've got kids coming in from countries all around the world. So there were kids from Sri Lanka, from Bhutan, from Nepal, and they're all conspiring on different things they can do back and forth together. And you see a vision of the multipolar world that's really wonderful. Because
yep.
You've just got unbelievably talented kids excited about building the future together and
right. Seeing
a way to do it, which is totally win-win. It's amazing. And it's very entrepreneurial. You know, it's all very entrepreneurial, whether they're going into government or business. And you see the excitement about the future, whereas when you're here, there's no excitement about the future. You know, people are kind of, oh, God, what are we going to do? And but this shift is happening whether we're part of it or not.
Yeah, and it goes back to something, what you're saying here goes back to something, again, I think that we've discussed before that we need to reiterate and emphasize about the cultural aspects of this. And to me, culture is partly, means partly the actual conceptual presuppositions that we have that we never examine. And one of the biggest ones at root in this finance capital culture is this idea that the pie is of one size and stable over time.
Okay.
And in other words, these people are operating with the idea that this is a closed system.
Right.
That there's nothing new being added to it and can never be. And of course, you know, they've got their own version of physics to back that up. But but the problem here is that it's not a closed system, and
right. The
pie can shrink or grow over time. And the problem is they're not intellectually enabled even to entertain the idea that you can grow the pie. Well, what does growing the pie mean? Well, it goes back to this idea of virtue. What you're talking about with these kids in Bangladesh is that they have essentially a virtuous view of themselves and of their neighbor, that
yes.
they can do good for yes. themselves and for their neighbor. And that includes
right.
investment, not just monetary investment, but investments of their time, investments of their intellectual capital and energy. And this is what we've got to get back to, I think, in this country, is the idea that investment means more than money. It means principally, you know, to recall our roots in the Protestant work ethic, it means principally
right.
Luther's view that every vocation has value and worth in the sight of God, and therefore you do your best in that vocation. And you do it not only for the glory of God, but you do it also for the well-being of yourself, your family, and your neighbor. In other words, it's a very localized view, again, that
right.
that he was talking about. And this is totally missing now.
Well, one of the things I heard in Australia is that the young people will not work for companies who don't have a net plus view of the total economic return. And the young people are demanding it of them, and if they don't satisfy it, they're going to have problems with the government projects and the government contracts, and they're going to have problem getting the young people to work for them. It was very interesting to hear the,
yep.
you know, the there's a real market function that's working. Okay, so the next trend is decentralization. Can we relocalize, which we've already discussed? But, you know, one of the things that helps see the world whole and brings together different threads we're talking about here is if, you know, I just said the kids and the young people want the companies to have a positive impact on their environment and a positive impact on the overall economy. They want them to have a positive total economic return. You can't do that unless you have integrity within, you know, the physical area in which you're operating.
Right.
So the local has to work if you're going to have a positive return to the environment or the total economy. So it's almost like they're demanding, hey, come back, you know, get out of your computer and come back into the real world here.
Yeah, and that's crucial. That's crucial.
Right.
Again, I think you've put your finger on yet another very important cultural phenomenon, because these big corporations, you know, love their computer-driven models. But it takes a real executive to get out of the boardroom and hop in the car and go look at the conditions in a local plant and talk to the local, you know, employees of that plant or whatever. Again, you know, this is just all this virtual computerized disconnect from human reality.
Right.
And it's
right.
going to take, like it or not, you know, it's going to take a conscious decision on our part to opt for the human. You know, it goes back to what I've said so many times about electronic books, and I know that people
right.
think I'm nuts here, but
No, you're not. Every subscriber I talk to agrees with you.
Yeah, the idea
yeah.
of research, you know, I keep telling people not everything is in the internet, and particularly particularly the real meaty stuff, you know, about our history, about our culture, about our philosophy, our science and its development. That's not on the internet, that's in books.
Right.
And you're gonna have to,
right.
you know, learn how to use a library to find these things, you know.
Right. Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, the one that worries me the most, I called it mind control, Mr. Global doubles down.
Yep.
Because this
yep.
is this is one of the invisible control technologies that it's hard for people to fathom exist. And if you look at what's coming with 5G, you know, I was down in Sydney with Jason Bowden-Smith, and we did we recorded a Celeri report on 5G.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm scared to death of this stuff. I think it's really, really very serious.
Oh, so. I am too, Catherine. And this, I'll tell you what, this is a yet another aspect of this dehumanizing fascination that the powers that be have with technology. This stuff is very real. I just received about 2 weeks ago a flood of emails that a new patent had been granted in the United States for a technology that can literally read your brain waves and right. get your username and passwords remotely. Well, if they can read your mind remotely, you know, they can inject waveforms to make you have certain emotional patterns or habits of thought and so on and so forth.
Right.
This is real.
Right.
And to me, it's an indicator of something else, Catherine, and this is a good thing. It's an indicator of just how scared they really are.
Right.
Because we're dealing with a handful of people that are so egregiously corrupt and evil that they know if they were ever exposed, they would be floating at the end of a yardarm on a rope. That's how scared they are. And they've got to perfect this stuff. So, you know, the other part I think that we need to consider in our cultural investment strategic planning is to consider how exposed we might be, wherever we may be, to these technologies and what can we do about them. And to understand that these technologies are going to want us to act a certain way.
Right.
And to try and thwart that as much as possible, you know, so long as it doesn't result in immoral behavior, of course. We don't.
Well, I used to, when
either.
I first got to Hickory Valley, I went to the ladies' room at one of the churches. It was just a little, you know, kind of closet bathroom. I sat down and I stared right into a cartoon of the Ten Commandments. And I thought, well, that's very cute. But whenever I start to want to do something in violation of the Ten Commandments, I just say, look, you know, either that's coming from the CIA or it might as well be, so you can just forget about it.
Right, exactly.
Right, you've got to have a functioning economy.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, but you've got to inculcate. You've got to make a list for yourself, you know, whether it's the Ten Commandments or your version of it. And then you've got to live by it, and it's a discipline designed to protect all of us from this stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, it goes back to the idea, if we're going to have a functioning economy, we've got to have a functioning culture. If we're going to have a functioning culture, the vast majority of people in it, in positions of power and out of positions of power, have to be virtuous. There's no other way about it. Now, virtue is coherence, and the problem here is that we need to re-examine all of the heroes that we have, you know, that the standard narrative that the powers that be have been shoving at us for so long, and examine them in detail. You know, President Lincoln being one of them. Is this guy the great big huge saint that deserves a mausoleum sort of temple in Washington, D.C.? Well, my answer would be no. Is David Rockefeller the great big success story that he and his family have said that they were? Well, my answer would be no. And so on and so forth. You cannot keep making heroes out of people who are corrupt and evil. You know, to a certain extent, we all have that contagion, but it's one thing to have the contagion and be fighting it and attempting to overcome it, and another to give into it in order to achieve fame, power, and fortune.
Well, the ultimate way to implement enforcement is to simply shun bad, you know, people who engage in bad behavior.
Yeah,
if we admire the people who engage in bad behavior, then we're never going to get out of corruption.
Exactly.
Right. So another trend I noted was that investment screening is growing because it's relatively easy to move your bank deposits and to grapple with moving your purchases. Investment screening has traditionally gotten a little bit, it's been more difficult, but I did a third quarter wrap-up called Can We Filter for Productive Companies? And it was very interesting because the Norwegian Wealth Fund just came out, Joseph, very interesting development, said, you know, we're not going to index funds because we reserve the right to not put money in something because they're, you know, they're destructive. It was quite marvelous. I put the commentary up on the website. So I wanted to bring up investment screening. And then finally, the trend I called Who Will Nourish the Field? And that gets back to what you have inspired all of us about, and that is, how do we nurture, build, protect, and build up our culture?
Well, it's funny, Catherine, that you mention this. Just yesterday, I want to tell a little story because I think this is really, really vitally important. Just yesterday, I received a magazine that I'm a subscriber to called Fine Art Connoisseur. And this morning when I went to bed, I decided, well, I'm going to, that'll be my bedtime reading this magazine. And in this magazine, I was stunned. I was shocked. There was an article in it about Chinese art schools in the People's Republic of China that are, that number one, teach that the foundation of the visual arts, painting, sculpture, so on and so forth, is the traditional Renaissance practice of learning how to draw, and to draw beautifully and accurately.
Wow.
And they had some pictures of drawings by Chinese artists. I swear to you, Catherine, they look like they could come straight out of the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci.
Wow.
They are that good. Now, what that tells me is that, number one, the Chinese understand, first of all, that there's something universal about Western culture. And number two, that universality did not come about by happenstance and chance. It was the result of a tradition of creativity. And that tradition has certain fundamentals that you must learn in order to be able to function within it in a creative fashion. Now, you know, obviously that's just the arts. But if you expand that paradigm and look at what has been happening in China, really since Deng Xiaoping, I think you've got a society there, and obviously a very old civilization as well, that understands that if you're going to have a functioning and be a part of a functioning global economy, number one, you have to understand the culture that created it, which is the Western culture, and number two, you have to integrate it with your own in a very creative fashion, which they are doing.
Right.
So this fascinates me, Catherine, because I think it is an indicator of what you and I have been trying to get across, and that's the link between healthy functioning economy, investments, and so on, and a healthy functioning culture. I was truly stunned by this. I still am, that they would understand things to that degree of detailed planning. This is not an accident. You know, these are all state, let's remember, these are all state-run schools sponsored by the Communist Party of all things.
Well, it's interesting. I picked up, when I was flying to Bangladesh from Hong Kong, I picked up the Cathay Pacific Airplane magazine,
mm-hmm.
and it was much thicker than most airplane magazines, and it was filled, it had six new fictional stories written by aspiring art writers in Asia,
uh-huh.
and Joseph, they were magnificent. They were,
yeah, I believe it.
They were all in English. They were fresh. They were young. So these are basically Chinese speaking kids, uh-huh. Young people writing these magnificent stories, and they were very sophisticated, And the whole magazine was filled with unbelievably rich cultural art and music references, and then these stories, and it was unbelievable. It's like reading something targeted at PhDs. And this was just a, you know, the airline magazine.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, too, that terrorist attack in Tehran recently that took place at an art gallery. And, you know, when I read that, I thought, wait a minute, an art gallery. So I went and looked up this art gallery in Tehran. And again, I was totally stunned at the quality of,
uh-huh.
of the art that was in this gallery. And incidentally, representational art, and I got to thinking, you know, well, under fundamentalist tenets of Islam, you're not supposed to have that at all. And here it is, you know.
Right.
And I, you know, there's something happening in Asia that you know, all the way from China to Iran, that is a very positive sign that they're giving such attention to the details of human creativity and trying to master the traditional craft, while we in the West are, you know, as I pointed out in the Louisville luncheon, are backing artists and musicians that are basically anti-art. They produce garbage. They produce junk. They produce ugliness.
Well, but you're talking about embracing a 26-step plus world, is what you're talking
exactly.
about. People are competing
exactly.
and embracing a 26-step world. There's no effort to simplify things at all.
Right.
There's celebration of the actual complexity of life.
Right, exactly.
So,
Prince Charles just recently also talked about this tendency and this phenomenon as well. And I think, to his credit, he's identifying the very same problem that you and I have talked about. So, yeah, there's something...
He probably something got it from you, Joseph. That's what you know.
No, I doubt. I doubt very, very
I don't
much
doubt it.
He sits around reading anything I've written.
No, but MI5 does, and they feed it to him.
Well, I think it's deeper than that. I think there's an awareness of people waking up in the West, particularly in Europe where their culture is under such assault, but here and elsewhere, Australia, Canada, Indonesia, is undergoing a similar thing. I think people are just tired of the ugliness movement. I don't know how else to put it.
Okay, last trend, environmental and geophysical stress. So we saw the president cancel the Paris Accord. I still want to know what that was really about. But it reminds us once again that the global spraying continues and all sorts of phenomena are happening, and we continue to wonder what are the real environmental and geophysical risks. Any comment on that?
Yes, I think that there is something going on with his cancellation of the Paris Accords, and what I think it has ultimately to do with is technology. The technology to manipulate weather, you've mentioned the spraying, and that's
right.
certainly part
right.
of that agenda. But I go back to something, Catherine, that occurred earlier this year when the Russians went into Syria with their intervention at the request of Bashar Assad. They had someone come out from their foreign ministry, I believe it was, that said that this is the first of many geopolitical, and here's an interesting word that they used, tectonic shifts. And I think that President Trump's decline of the Paris Accords has to deal with technology. I think there's something going on technologically, not just with the weather, but with technological manipulation of the planet itself. And that's an intuition here, Catherine. I'll probably be blogging about some of that this coming week, in fact. But this is along with the mind control technology, Catherine, this is something that internationally, first of all, isn't even really recognized as a problem, and number two, it's simply not regulated at all. There's no attempt
right.
to create a legal international structure to put limits on some of this stuff. And interestingly enough, one more point to notice about this, the Russians have been pushing for this, for such an international convention on these types of technologies, ever
Fabulous.
Since the SALT... Well, ever since the SALT I treaty between Brezhnev and Nixon.
Right.
The Russians have been pushing for this even under the Soviet era. And I find it very interesting that the American response to this proposal by the Russians, that clearly, I think, came from Brezhnev himself, was mystification. I don't know how else to describe it. The American negotiating team just apparently sat in the room when the Russians made mention of this and putting it on the table, just looked at each other kind of mystified as, what in the name of sense are they talking about? And I think it's come home to roost now. We've seen these technologies manifest themselves. I think one thing that people are going to have to be aware of is increasingly that these are going to be part and parcel of arms negotiations, talks of trade agreements, and so on. So don't look mystified when it starts getting mentioned in the major media, because it's been there for a very long time.
Right. And this is a lot more serious than North Korea.
Oh, much. That poor little nut over there.
I keep
really
being reminded of that great line from The Gladiator, "Are you not entertained?"
Yeah, exactly. You know, that little nut, you know, he's investing in all the wrong technology if he wants to be the great warlord. I've got to tell you.
But he's serving his purpose. He's doing it well.
Yeah, that's true. He's serving his purpose.
Okay, so I would encourage everyone to take a look at the long-term trends on the web presentation. And the reason Joseph and I went through this with you is again, it's so important that you, whatever time you have to track current events in the news, that you focus on actionable intelligence. And that's our hope by helping you see this, because we're going to turn now to economy and financial markets. And it's just amazing how much noise there is that makes no sense, Joseph, unless you can see these long-term trends. So I really appreciate your taking the time and making the suggestion that we step back and do that. And again, on that web presentation, there are great links for to help you sort of dive into any of the ones you want to go into deeper. So a lot of resources, including things that Joseph has helped us do over the last 4 years. Okay, you ready for economy and financial markets?
Sure.
Okay, so under the news, trends, and stories section on the navigation bar, if you choose to click on news trends, you'll get sort of a table of contents for that section. But then if you click on economy and financial markets, you'll be following along with the explosive number of stories that, you know, I kept saying to our top picks editor, look, we only want to put in the very, very most important stories. And we just kept cutting and cutting and cutting, but it kept growing. It's like kudzu. It just kept growing. Okay, so I said in the annual wrap-up that the slow burn, you know, that the runway was out, and now we're going into controlled demolitions. And I have to tell you, every day there's an announcement of a new pension fund in trouble and cutting back. It's just unbelievable. And what we're talking about is the retirement savings of millions of people who've worked their whole life and have extraordinary promises made to them, and there's not a mention of that. We're too busy watching, you know, CNN fight with this person and that person, which is, of course, all a distraction meant to keep you away from this. You know, because,
right.
And part of it is, I think, if CNN thought they really covered the pension fund problem, you know, their ratings would go into the basement. This is so frightening and depressing. People don't want to hear about it. But, of course, the really remarkable one is Illinois, which we just finished discussing. But Illinois is becoming the poster child for what can happen to public pension funds in this environment.
Right, right. And it's as you say, it's going to increase. I don't see any solution to this being proffered by any of the people writing the analyses, the articles. As you indicated, the major media is not even covering it. And the real problem is, again, this welfare warfare model that we've been under, that, you know,
right.
the state is going to take care of you and all of your grandchildren under the third and fourth generations, you know, and do so by fighting endless wars, you know, which it sounds off of the...
If state-sponsored mortgage fraud is siphoning all the money out of the pension fund, through the back door, and
exactly.
Internet-bubbled equities are siphoning money off through the back door, or pushing interest rates down, is, you know, transferring subsidy out of the pension funds into government. So, you know, if you look at all the different ways money's been siphoned out of the back door of pension funds. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's, you know, the federal government has no problem contemplating a $27 trillion bailout to the banks. Where's the, we could do a $27 trillion bailout of the pension funds.
Sure, exactly.
But there's not one ounce of conversation about that.
No, there isn't. And there won't be. There won't be.
Right.
Because they don't, you know, again, I think your model that really what they're trying to do is another pump and dump so that they can pick up hard assets with pennies on the dollar. And
right.
The reason they want to do that, again, goes back to the fact that their initial presupposition, the unexamined presupposition, is that the pie is of one size and stable over time.
Right.
You know, they're creating their own nightmare, and the real thing that we have to shift, if there's anything that we have to shift in the transition from global 2.0 to global 3.0 is, as you've said over and over, we have to shift out of the finance capital model and shift into the equity model. And the
right.
only way to do that safely in this environment where you have such a criminal mafia running the international financial system is you have to do it on a regional and local basis. This is key, and it's true not just here, but as you've pointed out, there's a cultural problem with people wanting to do business with China, but unable to do so because of the way the Chinese government regards contracts. Well, contracts are covenants, and covenants, again, depend more or less on two equal parties, both being having integrity and having virtue and wanting to fulfill their commitments. So, you know, it's again, it's all cultural here.
Well, this gets back to, you know, what I've always said is that we've had a negative return on investment to taxpayers, mm-hmm. and it just keeps getting deeper. And the question was, if you get a new administration willing to address that, what are the chances that that can be turned around? And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to geopolitics, but there are a couple of challenges of turning that around. And one is that the national security state and its costs are out of control.
Yep.
So we see McCain and the neocons pushing up the DOD budget. You know, Trump asked for a $57 billion increase, which was ridiculous on the face of it. But then the McCain and the neocons come back with a $100 billion plus increase. And of course, we know the challenge with that is if you appropriate the money, case law, according to Congresswoman McKinney, is that, you know, you're deemed to have satisfied the war clause under the, you know, sort of the provisions that went in after 9/11. And so that gives the administration the ability to, you know, basically go to war with, you name it, fill in the blank.
Yep.
And,
yep.
And that's a big problem, and one of the reasons it's a big problem is if you look at who's lobbying the administration to go to war with Iran or Russia, you know, a couple problems. One is they're serious, and two, they couldn't care less whether the United States fails or not, and three, a lot of them have dual citizenship. So we're not necessarily even looking at Americans.
Yeah, the dual citizenship, Catherine, I think it's high time to address this. And of course, by dual citizenship, you're meaning primarily people with dual citizenship in the United States and Israel.
Right.
It's high time to address this. You know, there was a wise man that once said, "You cannot serve two masters." You know, and sooner or later, that means you're going to choose one or the other. And sadly, the choice has been the other and not the United States. War with Russia, we'll get to that when we get to geopolitics, but all I can say, folks, if there's anybody in this audience, I doubt there is, but if there's anybody in this audience that thinks that we're capable of doing it and pulling it all off according to plan, think again.
That's what Cynthia insisted. You know, she said, we're going to lose that war.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
This is not a war, number one, that will be fought with nuclear weapons, number one. And number two, it's not a war, if it is fought with nuclear weapons, it'll be of a very limited nature. But if it is fought at all, it will be a very, very different kind of war than we've seen before. And Russia has been sending us messages over and over, you know, think twice before you do this, think twice. But we'll, as I say, we'll get to that when we get to geopolitics.
Well, one of the things Cynthia pointed out to me, and it's in the little excerpt we did for the video this week, is that the Duma and Putin outlawed dual citizenship for members of the Duma in Russia.
Yes,
and
they did.
That's significant because the Russian mafia and the, you know, sort of that whole group got passports to Israel when the rape of Russia occurred.
Yep.
And so both in the Ukraine and Russia, you have serious Russian mafia and related networks who have dual citizenship, and Putin has cut them out, which is, I think, maybe part of the reason we're being encouraged to go to war.
Absolutely.
But, right. It was very interesting. I don't know if you saw one of my favorite moments in the second quarter was when Oliver Stern was on Colbert and said, "Why are you worried about Russian interference? Israeli interference in the elections is much worse."
Oh, yes. You know, exactly. this whole Russia interference thing, when you compare it to the interference in U.S. elections, let's just remember, folks, that virtually every U.S. presidential candidate going back, you know, at least 30, if not more years than that, has had to make their obligatory statements to the American-Israeli lobby. And if that's not interference, and getting money, incidentally, from those lobbies, if that's not interference, I don't know what is. It pales. You know, it makes anything that Russia may or may not have done, which I haven't seen much evidence for yet, it makes that pale by comparison. So it's time for this country and other countries to have a real debate about this dual citizenship thing, and most importantly, to enforce the law. Under American law, none of this should be happening. None of it.
Now, I think one of the biggest events in the second quarter in terms of the economy and the financial markets was the Amazon purchase of Whole Foods and the comparison of that model with the Alibaba model and what the implementation of robotics and AI means. It's a great metaphor, you know, for this whole dynamic. And Harry Blaser has agreed to do an entire Solari report just looking in detail at the Amazon Whole Foods deal. I think it's that important. So we'll be doing that this summer. But it was very interesting. I think I sent it to you when, as soon as the deal was announced, Robin O'Brien, who I'm a great admirer of, she used to be a stock analyst, and she put out a tweet showing the drop in equity valuations in all the companies that sell groceries in the United States that have big market share. So Walmart, Kroger, Costco, and they took a huge beating. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And so the equity destruction was that you're seeing, you know, you could measure, here comes the equity destruction from this kind of very deflationary technology. Yeah. And we've been talking about this as part of the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0 for a long time, but now you're really seeing the hollowing out in very, very significant ways. But it's the most significant, you know, one action that I've seen where you can measure the equity destruction, and it was enormous.
Yeah, and again, I think, like you, I think in the long term it's not going to work for Amazon, but I think in the short term, again, like it or not, this means that we're confronted with choices. I'll tell you why I say that, because we have, where I live, we have, of course, these Whole Foods stores. Right. And I had been considering, you know, doing some grocery purchasing there, principally because they sell a lot of non-GMO organic produce and so on. After the Amazon announcement, I decided, no, I'm not shopping there. And I think that's, quite frankly, Catherine, what people are going to have to do. They're going to have to go to their Kroger's or Albertsons or what have you and do their shopping there, or even better, at a local farmer's market, you know, where they can get some food that's not GMO.
Right.
But, I share your concerns wholeheartedly there, truly.
Another thing I wanted to bring up, and of course you see it in the Amazon deal, because with the intelligence agency's cloud plugged into the Amazon cloud.
Yep.
And God knows how that relates to all of Amazon's databases. Wouldn't we love to know? You know, it brings up the question of surveillance capitalism. And again, I go back to the chart I described from Fortune magazine, where you see the revenues of the Fortune 500 explode, you know, and race ahead by more than a double the general GDP. And
right.
I think part of that explosion very much relates to the bulk acquisition by the NSA that we've been talking about here with Bill Binney and the great documentaries that Frederick Moser did about Binney's experience. Because I think the reason they wanted the bulk acquisition into the private contractors is so basically that could help fuel an explosion of surveillance capitalism, you know, Google, Facebook, et cetera.
Yes.
Surveillance,
you're absolutely right. And I'll tell you my personal experience here. I don't know if it will be valuable for people or not, but occasionally I do have to buy some of my research material from Amazon because it's just not, you know, available anywhere else. But if I can possibly help it, I don't buy from them at all. If I'm wanting a book, I go to another major retailer that still has the storefronts. But I'll tell you something else that scares me, Catherine. Over the years, I have noticed that when I have been researching and writing a book,
right,
that soon after I publish, or even sometimes before I publish a book in a certain field, someone else does it. And the book is not nearly as well written or researched. But I've noticed this pattern. Others have noticed this pattern that I know right in this field, and we've talked about it occasionally. And what we think is happening is precisely what you say. The intelligence community is using Amazon purchases, particularly from people that are flagged or tagged as authors or news commentators or journalists or whatever. And they're using their purchases to see what, get a general idea of what they're going to write about. So quite frankly, I've had to obfuscate my purchasing to buy things, you know, that I'm not really needing for research at this particular period. There's no doubt in my mind that Amazon does this. And again, another reason to use other retailers if you can and avoid that CIA-connected hydra. Absolutely.
Well, it's funny, you know, now when I feel like playing around and entertaining myself, I'll say to somebody on the phone, I have a headache, and then I'll send an email saying, I have a headache, and see how long it takes me to start getting emails marketing aspirin or headache.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay, so another thing I wanted to talk about is the European economy. We saw, you know, we came into the beginning of the year with Brexit, you know, all of the UK in a sort of tizzy about how they were going to implement Brexit and going back and forth with the Germans and the French. We come into the Austrian elections, then the Netherlands elections, and now the French elections, and the establishment is breathing a big sigh of relief, so the European equity markets are up, and part of that is the dollar is trending down for the first time in a couple of years. And so it looks like Europe has gotten sort of a temporary reprieve. At the same time, if you look under the rug at all the problems, you know, not to mention what's going on at the Vatican, it just seems to me that sort of the European establishment got the same kind of sigh of relief that the American heartland did on the U.S. election, but it still doesn't address the real problems.
No, all Europe did with the elections in France, in the Netherlands, in Austria, is it kicked the can down the road. Because the fact of the matter is that Merkel is running the policy, whether everybody else in Europe wants to admit it or not. You know, I remember Marine Le Pen at one point speaking in the European Parliament, addressed President François Hollande as Monsieur le Vice-Chancellor, Mr. Vice-Chancellor. You know, that pretty much said it all. Europe has done nothing but kick the can of her open borders refugee policy down the road. They've kicked the cultural problem that they're going to have to resolve down the road, and also the financial problem. This is not going to go away. Merkel's not going to change her policies, and as a result, that opposition in Europe is going to grow.
Right.
This may be a good time then to make a connect with the geopolitics, because I think there's three big stories going on in Europe, and they're Italy, Britain, and Germany. The Italian story right now, to me, Georgianne, probably heads the list because, as I mentioned earlier, we've got the banking bailout now of Monte dei Paschi di Siena by the Italian government. But we've also got a raging, I don't know what to call it, pedophilia, homosexuality ring scandal in the Vatican that just broke this week. And as a result, I think what is really happening in Italy has been kind of sidelined. In the Italian parliament right now, there are debates. I just did today my news and views on this story. There are debates in the Italian parliament about Italy leaving the European Union.
And really?
Most, Oh, yes. Yes, there are. And most.
Well, you know, Austria is trying to shut off the border
Yes, I know
with
that.
Italy, so that they all the immigrants get trapped in Italy.
Well, yeah, and this is, the refugee problem in Italy is a huge problem because I'll tell you why. Italian youth, in this article from Zero Hedge that I cited in my news and views today, Italian youth unemployment, Catherine, is running at about 37%.
Ugh.
Yeah, now you cannot have a functioning economy, refugees or no refugees, you cannot have a
Right.
functioning economy with statistics like this when at the same time you're bailing out banks to billions of dollars or billions of
Right.
euros.
Right.
And at the end of the article, Catherine, there was something that just really caught my eye. There was a German by the name of Heiner Flossbach or something like this, I forget his last name, that had worked for some years in the German Foreign Ministry. And his advice to the Italians was, go ahead and threaten to leave, because that's the only way you're going to get Merkel to change her policy.
Right.
And I suspect, Catherine, that over the long term, here's the problem, that the European Union, which shows no sign of wanting to change its fundamental structure from the bureaucrat regulation structure that it is to a genuinely open, participatory, republican sort of federative democracy. In other words, behind the facade of a union, you really have the old Nazi plan for a federated
Right.
Europe being run by Germany. That's really what's
Right.
going on here. So I suspect that without such change, the European Union is going to fragment and fracture back into its component nation states, great powers and minor powers and so on. Italy here for me is interesting because Italy really, as far as I can see, Catherine, has nothing culturally, politically, or in the long term financially to gain from remaining within the EU. So let's assume for a moment that it does leave at some point in time. If it were to happen tomorrow, I guarantee you what would happen. Russia would be there in a heartbeat because we've already seen, I've blogged about these stories, Italian cabinet ministers bucking Rome's official policy and just going to Russia to try and work out some deals, for
Right.
agricultural trade.
Right.
And the same thing is going to happen, I suspect, with China. China's going to come in and say, well, you've got all of these financial problems. Let us work out some financial deals with you and deal with it. So in other words, Italy does have options here. That's the key point. Italy does have financial
I
and
think Italy would
geopolitical
be
options.
so much better off out of the EU from what everything I've seen when I'm there.
Absolutely.
And the wonderful thing about the Italians is they understand there's something more important in life than making money.
Yes,
We
they
did not
do.
come here to make money. That's not our goal.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. So the Italians have a, I don't know, they have a sense of purpose
Well,
and a
they have a sense of
groundedness.
purpose because
Right.
they have a sense of their culture
Right.
and of its importance to the overall elaboration and development of Western culture. I mean, for crying out loud, it's the home of the Renaissance.
Right, exactly.
They have a sense of the value, the real value, but it's not a value that economic analysts can sit down and calculate. But they have a sense of the value of cultural institutions and traditions. And Italy, because of this, would be of all countries in Europe in a very unique position to deal with countries like Russia, which similarly has an understanding of the value of its own culture, particularly after the Soviet experience,
Right.
and the Chinese, who likewise, as I mentioned before, are doing just very interesting, amazing things in terms of their cultural projects. So I think Italy is in a much stronger position than the merely financial analysis would say it is. Now, I'm not saying that if Italy does leave, it wouldn't have problems. It would. But in the long term, I think those problems would be mitigated and ultimately dissipated. And you'd see real productivity return there. They have a large economy. People are not aware, most people are not aware of how large their economy is. So yeah, I think Italy is a crucial one. The other thing I think is crucial, if I may, is not to coin a pun, is the Brexit and the recent British elections, in which Prime Minister May suffered what can only be called a severe trouncing for her goals and for the Conservative Party.
Right.
And here, Catherine, I'm going to indulge in just wildly on the end of the twig speculation.
He's hanging on to the leaf beyond the twig. Okay, go
ahead.
Well,
I have a picture on my website of a goat. I'm a Capricorn, so I have a picture on my website somewhere, or on my Facebook wall somewhere, of a little goat standing right at the end of a branch of a tree. You know, the branch, and the branch is sagging, you know, under the weight. So that's kind of what my speculation here is. But let's look for a moment at Great Britain. I think Britain is in a very odd political situation, and I don't think we've seen the equivalent of this situation really since July of 1940. You know, France has just been conquered. Neville Chamberlain's government is in tatters. You know, the policy of appeasement not only didn't work out, but now, you know, Western Europe's overrun. I think we're at the Halifax Churchill moment of history. And what do I mean by this? Well, Prime Minister May has to form a coalition with what the British press is calling an extremist Irish right-wing party, the DUP. And on the other side of the aisle, the Labour leader, Mr. Corbyn, is calling for a general election. I think eventually, regardless of whether or not that happens, I think you're going to see a vote of confidence take place in the House of Commons. And it may be that Mrs. May would lose that vote and you would have a general election. Now, the problem here is basically what we were faced with this last presidential election. We were faced with two candidates that nobody really wanted, but you know, it was for most people a choice of what they considered the lesser of two evils. And that's kind of the same thing in Great Britain, but there's a difference in Great Britain that could make this a Halifax Churchill moment of history, and that's the crown.
Right.
Because some of Mr. Corbyn's policies would not be amenable to the people that have sustained the Conservatives in power since Tony Blair.
Right.
And I mentioned Tony Blair because Tony Blair, in 2003, his Labour government did a study of the existing powers of the Crown under the British Constitution in 2003. And they pointed out that, again, the Crown had the right to appoint governments, in other words, to choose the Prime Minister. This is what happened in July of 1940 when Chamberlain was replaced with Churchill. The Crown literally made a decision between Churchill and Lord Halifax. I think we might be looking possibly at a situation where that could, I'm not saying it will, but I'm simply saying that it could happen again.
Right.
And if it does, it will provoke a constitutional debate, perhaps even a crisis in Great Britain, such as we've not seen before, because you've got the Labour equivalent of the progressives over here that will view that as trammeling and trampling on democracy and so on and so forth. You'll have the traditional components within British society, the Tories, that will probably back whatever the monarch does. But I do think that the potential is there for another kind of Churchill-Halifax moment.
It's interesting, though, if you look at the people who voted for Brexit.
Right.
You know, as you know, I believe the Queen very much wanted Brexit to happen.
I do, too.
And if you look at who voted for Brexit, I think they were voting with her. And
yeah.
And if you look at how she's sort of nurtured and brought, you know, William and I forget what his wife's name is, but, you know, sort of the heir apparent along,
right.
I think that's all designed to capture and hold that that part of the population in support of what the monarchs want. So I think British royalty will be able to pull it off.
Well, I do too. You know, I'm not saying that I'm either anticipating nor I certainly would not want to see a constitutional crisis in Great Britain. But
right.
You know, I'm in agreement with you here that I think the Crown itself was quietly behind the Brexit vote. And the reason I say that
right.
is not simply because we had that strange incident under Prime Minister Cameron where the Vice Premier was summoned to Buckingham Palace. And the dinner conversation that the Queen chose was to, you know, have him name three good things about staying in the European Union. You know, well, that's kind of an Elizabethan way of saying I'm not for this. You know, but you know, God bless her. But the other thing I think is a strong indicator of where the Crown itself stands with all of this is that shortly after the Brexit vote, you began to hear all of these rumors coming out of the Commonwealth. And, you know, I said at the time that Brexit was setting the stage for a revival of the British Commonwealth of Nations as a
right.
real functioning political and cultural entity. You know, it's a soft
right.
culture power card. Well, lo
right.
and behold, you had the British talking about extending associate member status to the United States. And, you know, this clearly, I think, is coming from the Crown and from certain elements within the peerage as well. So that's another development we have to watch on the geopolitical stage. You haven't heard much about it, but I can almost guarantee you that President Trump, when he does talk to Prime Minister May and some of the British delegates there, that's going to be a subject of conversation that's going to be held behind closed doors. I can
right.
almost guarantee it.
Right, and it's very important to remember that Trump's mother was Scottish. So
Exactly.
His ties are much deeper than I think most people realize by from his style. I do
yeah.
think this, you know, if you look at the people who voted for Brexit, they're firmly behind the Crown. But
right.
the reality is the Conservatives have to start showing a little bit more trust and concern for the common man. And I think that's where May has really blown it. Yeah,
absolutely. Corbyn and the Labour Party have really tapped into that. And I was told by some British friends of mine that there were Brexit people that crossed the lines and voted Labour in this last general election. And that does not surprise me in the least.
Right.
It really, really does not. So
right.
there's lots to watch going on in Great Britain. The third thing I think we have to look at very carefully and keep a watch on geopolitically is of course, Germany.
Right.
Merkel this quarter, you know, again, I'm in that Joan Rivers frame of mind here, you know, can we talk?
But, or as Ricky Ricardo would say, let me explain you something. Lucy,
let me explain you something, Lucy. The news coming out of Germany, particularly in the last 2 to 3 weeks of this quarter, has just been, to me, bizarre and profound, because in reaction to the American sanctions, I just had a blog, as a matter of fact, on my website just a couple days ago, and the blog title is Germany Has Had It and Considers Sanctions Against the USA. You know, and this is coming from, as is always the case with Merkel's government, it's coming from people either in her cabinet or at a sub-cabinet level.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something to watch, because what they're talking about is sanctions against imports of American energy. That's number one. Number two is that Merkel herself and some of her ministers have repeatedly made statements that since the Senate passed more of these ridiculous, in my opinion, ridiculous Russia sanctions, that Germany and Europe are going to have to go their own way for security arrangements. And they have been quietly putting into place, and this again is a story that I don't think most people are aware of, but they have been quietly integrating the militaries of some of the countries surrounding Germany, not Denmark, but Holland and the Czech Republic, as units under the command of the Bundeswehr, basically. So you're watching the creation in slow incremental steps of a pan-European army, again, under German, more or less under German control. And to me, you know, this is deja vu, because we're looking at the internationalization of the Wehrmacht that began in 1942 all over again, when you have French and Dutch and Czech and other units being formed from those nations to go fight the Russians, you know. Right. I don't think that's what Merkel has in mind for this, though. So Germany, and just today, Merkel came out and said that, you know, as far as world security and stability goes, Germany and China are going to need to cooperate on this. So in other words, the signals coming out of Berlin are very, very strong. Merkel, who was, I think, at least for a period, considered to be firmly within the Atlanticist camp in Europe, now seems to be reversing course.
It's interesting. Maybe Trump's crazy making is causing lots of people to create many more tracks of talking to each other.
Well, that is happening, obviously.
Right.
I think that is one result. Geopolitically, this is a huge move, though. This means ultimately, and I've predicted this years ago, but it means ultimately that Germany is going to cast its lot, and therefore Europe's lot, with the BRICS bloc, with Russia, China, and that whole Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I think that's inevitable. And she's making the opening moves now, signaling this in some very strong language. So this is yet another story to watch. From a simple realpolitik point of view, Catherine, I am stunned looking back on the years since 9/11. At how the United States has managed to push away our most powerful allies in Europe and, you know, let's look across the other side of the hemisphere to Japan and their rearmament and the negotiations that Mr. Abe has undertaken with the Russians regarding the Kuril Islands and Japanese investment in Siberia. So we're watching it happen, whether we like it or not, and there seems to be, you know, like you, there seems to be no sanity whatsoever in Washington with the Ziocon crowd.
I think the goal is to make Israel great again.
Oh, yeah, I do, too.
I don't think the goal is to make America great, and so America is to be harvested, you know, for their ends, and I think they believe there's a safe place in the world if they destroy the United States and possibly Russia.
Yeah, I got bad news for them if they think that. But
tie back and close out. I want to talk a little bit about investors before we continue on with geopolitics, so we close out the financial and the economic and financial markets. One of the things that we saw in the second quarter, you know, the U.S. market now has essentially 25% of the global profits, but 50% of the market valuation. So market valuations have run way ahead. And with the dollar coming down, we've seen the European and Asian markets outperform the U.S. markets significantly, you know, really for the first time in a long time. But there's no doubt about it that the U.S. markets are high. And of course, everybody was expecting a correction in the equity markets, and it hasn't happened whatsoever, particularly with the European establishment feeling flush. But what's interesting, Joseph, is that what you see the same thing in Asia that you see in the United States, and that is investors still prefer real estate.
Right.
Part of it is they're nervous about how high the securities market is, but they're also trying to keep their assets a little bit harder and a little bit, you know, more grounded. Even though we're seeing technology absolutely squeeze and competition squeeze income and margins, if you look at asset valuations, we're watching literally a hyperinflation through the property markets in many markets around the world. So, Vancouver, Sydney, San Francisco, Hong Kong, you know, all around the Pacific Rim, the prices are just exploding. And of course, Sydney's property market never dropped during 2008. And they just, every time I'm there, they say, oh, well, it has to stop now. And then, of course, it just keeps going up. So you are seeing the bleed out of the central bank monetary inflation hitting the property markets in many of these areas.
Yep.
So I just wanted to note that, because now with property markets bubbled and this equity markets bubbled and income squeezed, you know, everybody's looking around and saying, oh my God, where do I go? And I think it's particularly interesting. Finally, we see, though I always hate to mention his name, the head of Facebook running around and arguing for a minimum income and basically writing checks to people and just providing a minimum income. And we've seen countries around the world now starting to do that. And there's no doubt about it. You can see there's a terrible, terrible fear in the establishment of what the continued impact of robotics and artificial intelligence is going to do.
Yep, yep. And you can't blame them, particularly vis-a-vis the Pacific Rim and skyrocketing property prices and so on, because the other thing that, from their standpoint, they're looking at a tremendously destabilizing situation, and they're correct.
Right, right.
But there are other destabilizing factors that they've also got to factor into their thinking, particularly in the Pacific. You've seen the rise of radical Islam in Indonesia, in the Philippines.
Right.
The Philippine leader is not acting very friendly toward the United States right now, and going so far as to claim that, you know, the United States is actually arming ISIS in the Philippines to overturn his government. And again, you know, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that's the case.
Well, is it the United States or is it simply the narcotics trafficking syndicates who are mad that he's finally shut down the narcotics trafficking?
Well, I think it's both, because we both know, of course, the CIA has been up to its earlobes with international drug trafficking as
right.
one of its funding mechanism sources for its covert projects. So, you know, I think it's both, quite frankly. But you're looking at two countries that, you know, are stable, but there are problems internally within them, with the Philippines and Indonesia. And, of course, once you start thinking in those geopolitical terms, then you're thinking the Chinese are going to have a say about it, the Australians are going to have a say about it, the Japanese. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. This could be a factor for why people are investing so much in property in that region rather than in riskier types of investments for the long term. I think a lot of people are just looking at how are these governments going to handle this situation,
right.
and is the United States going to step in and make things worse as it usually does when it steps in. So
I just have to mention the last story because, you know, I go along and I make the assumption that certain things could never happen. And then something happens that's so far outside your
yep.
concept of reality that you just, it's like getting, you know, dropped on the seesaw when you were a kid in the, you know, during recess.
Yep.
And I don't know if you've ever had the wind knocked out on you on those big seesaws, but it's just,
yep.
and so here's the story. Feds Yellen gives an interview and says she expects no new financial crisis in our lifetimes. So,
yeah.
Well, here's the thing. You know, you look at it and you think, why would anyone who understood the financial system say that? And then you realize, well, it's possible she doesn't understand the financial system, which possibly is the most frightening interpretation of what that, you know, better we know that she's lying and just trying to make sure that the average investor feels safe.
Right. Right.
But having lived through Hank Paulson not knowing that he couldn't let AIG down, you know, I had to contemplate, is it possible she doesn't know? Any theories on what that was about?
Well, listen,
because here's
Catherine.
What investors can do. We can just pretend that the central banks will fix it, whatever it is.
Well, yeah. I hate to say it, Catherine. When I saw that article, I just saw it this afternoon. When I saw that article, I have to agree with you. My initial reaction was, no, she's not lying, because I don't think she's smart enough to lie like that and do it and pull it off.
Right.
I'm with you. I don't think she knows what she's talking about. And
yeah,
that's scary.
I think it's a if you brought up the Churchill Lord Halifax moment, I'm bringing up another AIG Hank Paulson moment.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. This to me makes no sense, but right. on the other hand, Catherine, we've discussed so many times that the financial elite themselves, you know, I've said it for years, when you keep surrounding yourself with the same type of yes men, or yes women in this case,
right?
If you keep doing that, eventually you box yourself into a corner where you're dealing with people that are so stupid they can't think their way out of a new situation. And this is what frightens me.
The positive thing, I will say from watching who's subscribing to the Solari Report and who I bet is subscribing to Giza Death Store, I'm amazed at the number of people in that milieu who are now seeking real information.
Well, yeah. This is the other thing, because this is all, again, it's all cultural. The people that are backing this central bank model and the analysis that they're putting out, these people are believing their own propaganda. This is what's so frightening.
Right.
You know, they're watching the fake news that they themselves, you know, own the networks that are putting it out.
The blowback is the mind control is persuading you that, you know, whatever
right.
the thing you use to mind control that other person is now taking over your mind. It's the ultimate in mind control
yeah.
blowback. Okay, so let's jump to geopolitics, because there's so many fun things to talk about. So I just want to mention the free speech and corporate media meltdown. Now, I really do believe that the whole, you know, much of what we're watching is not the corporate media melting down. They're basically, you know, their job is to entertain and distract in a way that gets ratings, so you're not focusing on what's happening to your pension fund. So I think that this is a business, and their challenge is, you know, if you look at for example, the president's fight with CNN, I mean, the guy who's running the CNN news that he's fighting with is the guy who made him as a reality TV show host.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You almost wonder if they're not coordinating, you know, in the mornings every day. So, but there's no doubt about it. There's an incredible, explosion of reality TV, I don't know what you call it. We need a new word for it, because it's got nothing to do with news.
And it's got nothing to do with fake news. To me it looks like a Chopin Fantasia translated into television. You know, not to cast aspersions on Chopin.
Maybe it's like the new American version of the Monty Python show.
Well, this is it has that feel to it. This is not only free speech meltdown, but it's just common sense sanity meltdown that you're watching. And Catherine, I don't know what to make of this, other than that, again, this is a cultural phenomenon that inevitably results when you abandon virtue for
right.
values that are not grounded in any sort of historical tradition or anything else, and that are grounded only in the organizational or personal, and most often both, pursuit of power. You had these articles about Merkel and police raids in Germany for what people have been posting on Facebook against the government's policy. Well, you know, all that indicates to me is that the Germans, like Americans, Canadians, Australians, Britons, French, are fed up with the mainline narrative, which they can see in their own personal lives is
right.
not true.
Right.
And so we have this Orwellian push to some sort of Soviet propaganda system where, you know, the state's putting out a propaganda line, and you'd better believe it, or else we're going to raid your home and ship you off to a psychiatric hospital. Well,
I'll tell you what happened to the Soviet Union. Wherever I travel to, and I have a lot of, you know, I traveled a lot in the second quarter, I'm going to travel a lot in the third quarter, I'm going to be in Europe and across, you know, on the East Coast, the United States, but wherever I go, this is I can't tell you how devastating this is for our global brand.
Yeah.
And that's very serious in terms of both power and money. So this is a serious problem.
Catherine, you've hit your head on something that I think people really, particularly in the United States, or Canada or Britain, have to wake up to, and wake up real fast. And I'm not going to pull any punches here. Number one, the progressivist ideology, which has, in my mind, created a huge part of the problem here, is breaking down because its insanity is manifesting itself. People really have to wake up and understand that this is an ideology that has basically held sway in one form or another, sometimes very overt and sometimes very covert, for the last 100 plus years. But the other thing, more importantly, is particularly in the United States case, the reason that we are losing our allies and friends is precisely because the culture is unstable. The political class is therefore unstable. The culture is so dumbed down and irrational that the political class is dumbed down and irrational and behaving like that. So in other words, if the United States wants to restore its position in the world, it cannot do so. I'm adamant on this. It cannot do so without a restoration of virtue in the popular culture. And that means full bore across the board, a restoration of the understanding of our cultural tradition and institutions, where they come from, why they're there, and enforcement of them under the existing Constitution as it understood them. And if that happens, then our position will be restored. But what is happening is people can no longer look at this country and see in it a beacon of freedom and morality. And it's been happening slowly, but the process that was begun after World War II, you know, that we're going to be policemen to the world, well, being policemen to the world is fine and dandy if you have reasonably moral people running it. But when you have a dual citizenship, Zio-con, politically insane, financially corrupt, elite class that has no moral virtue to commend it, this is what happens.
Right.
This is what happens. This is what must be restored. There is no two ways about this. Sorry, that end of rant.
Well, you see people around the world saying, look, I don't have, you know, I have to deal with real things. I have real problems. I have to generate, you know, I have to get up and do something useful to people or else I won't, you know, earn the rent money. So no time for this. One of the things I feel very, very strongly, and it's the reason we had the Constitution and enforced the Constitution as a theme, we've seen an effort over the last 2 years to go to the different states and get a state support, get 36 states to come together and support having a constitutional convention. It's why earlier this year we did the interview with Edwin Vieira, top constitutional scholar, on why constitutional convention is basically a way of destroying the Constitution.
Right.
And so, you know, I started beating this drum, you know, enforce it. But I will say this, when you look at the geopolitics, I think we missed a bullet when the Clintons didn't get the White House. At the same time, if you look at the different U-turns that Trump took from April 1st on, you know, we're watching the Zio-cons or the neocons ascendant once again, you know, almost as if the Clintons were in there. And that puts us in terrible danger. And if you look at what I described under, you know, both with my interview with Dr. McKinney and in the in what I've written in the second quarter wrap-up, what I'm saying to people is, look, you know, we can't kick the can anymore. You either enforce the Constitution, or if you look what's going to happen to each and every one of us, we're going down. And this is not something that Joseph and Catherine and a few people can go off and do.
Right.
It's going to take all of us. So, You need to understand that you have lived for your entire life, if you're a U.S. citizen, with enormous blessings that you take for granted. And if they can tear up the Constitution, you know, get ready for them to balance the budget with your house, your assets, your retirement savings, and your life.
Yep.
This is, you know, we're talking now about more than a financial coup d'etat. We're talking about a coup that could, you know, destroy you or cause you to die. This is very dangerous.
And reduce your children and grandchildren to serfdom, yes.
Right.
Catherine, I call this Constitutional Convention thing the con. It's
right.
The Constitutional Convention con. It's the con.
Right.
And you and I have said this before many times, and I'll repeat it just for good measure. You know, to have a Constitutional Convention and entrust it to the likes of Hamilton, Madison, Jefferson, and so on is one thing. To have a Constitutional Convention and entrust it to the likes of Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush, Bernie Madoff, you know, and people of that ilk is quite another. And it is, there's no doubt in my mind that it would issue in precisely what you're talking about. It's
right.
Really an excuse to do, under the guise of a constitutional reform, it's really an excuse to legalize their crime post facto, let them get away with it, and enslave everybody else.
Right, and balance the budget with everybody's else assets instead of the money they stole.
Balance the budget with everybody's assets, and I guarantee you, if that happens, Catherine, the problem is it wouldn't, I don't think, issue in slavery. I think it would issue in a civil war.
Right.
Because there will be people in various regions of the country that will just have had it at that juncture. And if that happens, incidentally, the other possibility is you have foreign intervention, and we don't want that.
Right. And let me play the bad guy. I think that's one of the reasons they're prototyping the Kingsman technology.
Yep.
So, you know, if you look at the Chuck E. Cheese brawl or any of these sort of, you know,
right.
inexplicable phenomena of 30 adults suddenly starting to fight with each other, I think that's why I'm so concerned about the mind control technology, because
yep,
I think
they're
planning on that to be a critical defense when that when that pushback comes.
Yeah.
Okay, and another thing I wanted to talk about in geopolitics, and it's bleeding over into both financial markets. You know, the integration of geopolitics and markets is getting tighter every year.
Yes.
And that is that we continue to see Asia strong and rising. Now, India's had a gangbuster year, but there's been great pain there because of the sort of central controls and the implementation of digital payments and other systems and sort of the war on cash. But, you know, Asia continues to rise. And as it does, Joseph, the size of their markets and the size of their, you know, the growth of their consumer markets is completely replacing both the EU and the U.S. And that's a very new reality for Americans. One of the things I've been struck with over the last couple years is how kids all over the world are learning multiple languages, but American kids aren't. You know, and I took great notice of the fact that Trump's grandchildren are learning Mandarin.
Right.
So, you know, but this is a very a combination of Asia rising and the impact on incomes of the new technology means that we're coming into a very different world.
Yes, it is. And you put your finger on something else that, like you, I've shared a concern about this for years and years and years, and that is in a multicultural world, the American college graduate cannot function.
Right.
Because on average, he or she is coming out of the American quackademic institutions with increasingly degrees in nonsense. And they're not multilingual. You know, we have Europeans begin learning a foreign language, you know, in addition to English, when they're in elementary school. We postpone learning foreign languages in this country till high school.
Right.
There's no reason for this, number one. And number two, in that kind of culture with sagging school scores, and I'm going to be doing a blog this week on the effect of Common Core thus far on our ever-falling standards, and it's, as one might imagine, not good. When we're graduating people from these quacademies that indebt them to between $100,000 and $250,000 in student loans, give them degrees in pseudo-subjects, and make sure that they don't even know the English language properly, nor can write it properly, but are more concerned about gender-neutral language, and put them up against the graduate of a Chinese university or college that come out of there knowing mathematics or the arts thoroughly and knowing other languages and being able to converse in them, we're doomed. We are going to become a third nation or third world republic, banana republic with nukes. There's no excuse for this, Catherine. There really is no excuse for this.
Right. Well, I think it's... I said I wanted to focus on actionable intelligence. I think it's essential that everyone listening to this turn around, whether it's your kids, your grandkids, the children you love, the children you know, we've got to make sure they get great educations, and that education means they've got to be successful and effective in a multipolar world. And that's the message of what you see when you look at what's going on around the world. And, you know, and it's a wonderful world full of fascinating things to do. There's a lot going on. So there's plenty of opportunity, but you've got to get out of the trance. And you've certainly got to not run up a huge amount of student debt. And it's not necessary. There, you know, there are a lot of kids who are going to school in Eastern Europe and abroad for pennies on the dollar of what they have to pay here. So,
and they're learning a different culture, they're learning a different language, or in some cases exposing themselves to an aspect of our Western culture that's very important. And Catherine, this, you know, this is actionable intelligence. This is precisely one of the things I mean when I say own the culture, because by owning the culture, you're taking responsibility to teach it and hand it down to your children or to whomever else may ask you or make an inquiry about it. Because the system, I'm sorry, I'll say it again, the American educational system from kindergarten to postgraduate school in this country is now top to bottom, across the board, fraudulent.
Right. So that means we've all got to take... You know, I've got to have a learning plan for my life, and I've got to help my kids and grandkids and the kids around me do the same, and make sure it's effective and it's cost effective. So
and to seize every opportunity that comes our way to, you know, to open our eyes to the opportunities that come our way, to provide whatever instruction or handing down of our civilizational tradition as we can. And it doesn't have to be an hour-long lecture. It can be just simply a little factoid dropped into a conversation with a younger person.
Right.
You know, but to recognize the opportunities when they come.
Okay, so geopolitics. Now we turn to the Trump administration and the Trump report card. Are you ready?
Yes, you know, I am.
I'm going to cut to the chase because I said last time, you know, if we don't reinvent our strategy for the world and with it how we organize and run the budget, you know, I'm going to give the Trump administration an F on the budget. So I did, and so did you. Now, you did last time. I was a little more kind. But, you know, all these different policies and intentions come together in the budget, and the budget's what's real.
Yep.
You know, where's the time going to go? Where's the money going to go? And the reality is this whole thing is broken down in the budget, because what we've got, you know, the Trump budget came out and said 57 trillion more for the military. So instead of reinventing the military or reinventing the military for a Make America Great Again role in the world, what we had was, let's just throw more money at the problem. And then, of course, John McCain said, oh, no, let me double down and throw twice as much money as you.
And, Catherine, what disturbs me here is, you know, we're talking just about the defense budget, number one. We've still got this health care thing.
Right.
But let's look at this defense budget for a moment, because, quite frankly, this whole business of reinventing the military. Number one, we've reinvented a transgender military that doesn't look to me to be very effective. Number two, we have seen for the last, 2.5 to 3 years, indications from our potential military opponents, chiefly Russia, that indicate that they're getting a lot more bang for their ruble than we are. We have the Donald Cook incident in the Black Sea of $1 billion or whatever amount of money that this Aegis-class missile frigate costs, where a Russian plane has an electronic system that shuts the whole thing off.
Right.
And we had a replay of that incident in the Baltic Sea with the Donald Cook. Now we've just seen the USS Fitzgerald in Japan, which I guarantee was a message either from Russia or China that we have an electronic warfare capability that you people can't even guess at. We're not getting bang for the buck in this budget. We have weapon systems that cost too much, that are ineffectual, and this is a result of the climate of corruption that has persisted. So I'm not only sticking with my F here, Catherine, not just for the defense budget, but, you know, healthcare and all the rest of it, education and all of this. We're simply not getting the bang for our buck. What we're doing is we're feeding a bunch of people at the trough who are producing ineffective systems.
Well, we're propping up the stock market with government contracts and purchases. Right. I mean, here's the thing. Did Donald Trump, if the top defense contractors had come to Donald Trump and said, look, we'll give you a plane to fly around and pay you $1 a year. Will you run around the world and be an arms salesman for us? He would have said no.
Yeah.
But what has happened?
Yeah, exactly. We've seen a reversal. And I, like you, Catherine, I'm sticking with my F grade there. And I'm not looking at this as a good sign. And don't even get me started on his arms deal with Saudi Arabia. I quite frankly think we need to dump that relationship, but again, that's the Ziocon lobby faction within the
American
government.
Well, here's what happened, because, you know, I published your rant in early April. We did our report card at the end of March, you know, as of March 31st, and then shortly thereafter, in 1 week, the Trump administration took 5 major U-turns and flipped out of Make America Great Again into Make Israel Great Again.
Yep.
And, you know, basically you had McMaster coming up with $35 billion a year plans to go back into Afghanistan in a major way.
Yep.
And when it's clear we can't win,
right?
You know, we can't win that war. And so we were back on the 7 countries in 5-year plan that Wesley Clark laid out. And of course, it hasn't taken 5 years. We spent $6 trillion and only gotten 2. And that required major destruction and major, you know, defining us as a genocider globally. So you kind of look at it and you say, okay, what is really going on here? Why is it that we've decided to bet the ranch on more wars in the Middle East? What's that about? And I still don't know what it's about. I really don't.
My suspicion, Catherine...
Unless it's Make America, Make Israel Great Again.
Yeah, that's it. It's Make Israel Great Again. And in the process, get rid of a major potential enemy by allowing that enemy to do your bidding in making you great again. It's a very insidious game. It's been going on for quite a while.
But for some reason, Trump says, I mean, basically Trump is acting in complete contradiction of everything he not only ran on, but said in his inauguration speech, and the question is why. And we see, you know, Bannon in the corner and Kushner ascendant, and the question is why. Why is Trump doing this?
Well, I suspect, since we're putting it in terms of the dual citizenship Ziocon lobby problematic or perspective, that somehow they got to him. How I have no way of knowing, but it's also a sign that whatever deep state backers he may have had, they have been neutralized.
Right.
So I don't think he's quite out of fight or steam yet, but it's a very disturbing development for me as it is for
you.
Well,
here's the thing. I do think that we are infinitely better off in many ways that Trump won the election than the Clintons.
Oh, yes, so, I do too.
So if you look at what happened with TPP, if you look at what happened with the Paris Accord, if you looked at what's happened with immigration, you know, on many different fronts, you know, I would say that Trump has done a better job of keeping his commitments than most candidates
I would agree.
Have traditionally. At the same time, you know, it's exactly what I said when I wrote Coming Clean Over the Fiscal Cliff. We have a black budget. We have a hidden system of finance. And until we can reinvent how we do the budget and deal with that as well, you know, we've got to deal with the overt side and the covert side at the same time.
Right.
But we are a prisoner of our secrets, and what we're getting as a result of it is basically insane.
Yeah, what we're getting is not only insane, but it's unstable and unsustainable.
Right.
And I think this is why, you know, this is one reason you see so many states in the country now revolting and doing little things to secure their own future if things should ever go south with the federal government, which I think if it continues on the course that it's on, inevitably is going to happen. So, yeah, I'm with you. There's something going on here. I think, to put it in a bit different perspective, I think when you look at some of the other things that Trump has done, it's showing signs to me that he's making some sort of strategic calculus of what can he win, where does he have to compromise to get certain things done, and what can't he win. So
right.
I do think, you know, in the war gaming and mapping the swamp, I'm still giving him a B there, because I think he is trying to do some strategic calculus. The problem is, as you've pointed out, that he's not doing what he should be doing in terms of recruiting and building a team.
Right.
So my grades have kind of fallen there in terms of recruiting a team and making the team functional.
Right. If you look at the grades that we've gotten, that we've given him high grades on, you know, so high grades on vision, recruiting a team. I gave a lower grade on building a team. I think he's not done a good job of building teamwork. You know, he's an entrepreneur used to working with family in a highly politicized environment. I think he's
right.
got to learn that. I think he's accomplished a lot to date. He's a very hard worker, so we give him high. Both of us gave A's for effort. I think he is a good communicator. I mean, he's a feisty guy, which is not necessarily the best thing in a president. But I also think he's learning about war games. He announced finally that he would put together a war team. And he's trying to build bottom-up support, but I think there's a lot more he could do to reach, you know, across the aisle, both internationally and domestically, and so we've given him C's on building bridges.
Yeah.
I don't think he knows yet how to manage the executive branch bureaucracy, so I assume his team will learn. Where I've been really disappointed is the effort to come up with a grand strategy for America, because it's almost like we've completely fallen out of his vision into the make Israel great again, and it's kind of like, well, do we have a vision, or are we just bouncing around between different constituencies?
Exactly.
Right. But I will say this guy's a hard worker and he's growing in the job, so and I gave him pretty high marks for continuing to try. And of course, you know, I have to give him major credit for attacking the fake news. And
yes, I do too.
And very courageous. And finally, the last thing I have to say, I had a subscriber said, well, why are you so enthusiastic about Trump the other day? And it was yesterday. And I said, well, you know, I like being alive. And I like my allies being alive, too. And so I feel that, you know, I think that, and this comes back to the idea of, okay, it's time for all of us to do something to enforce the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know, you can't expect Catherine and Joseph to do more than we're doing, because we're doing everything a human possibly can be. But at some point, we'd like to be able to stay alive.
Yeah, that would be really nice.
So
the biggest step we can do, you know, to enforce the Constitution is, number one, read it. And I would say read it in the context of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, and the Bill of Rights.
And the Bill of Rights, yes.
Right.
And then read the Federalist Papers, and please, my friends, read the Anti-Federalist Papers.
Right.
Because there's two sides of the story, even for the Constitution.
Right.
Familiarize yourself with that, and, you know, for those listening overseas, familiarize yourself, you know, with the Canadian system, the Australian system, and very importantly, the British Constitution. I have people, Catherine, telling me all the time, the British don't have a constitution. And I say, what do you mean they don't have a constitution? Well, they don't have anything written down. And my response is, they've got gobs written down. It's just not on one piece of paper that has constitution right at the top of it.
Okay, well, it's been it's been a wonderful second quarter. One of the things I'm most looking forward to in the third quarter, we'll talk about it later, is there's a pipe organ coming.
Yes. I certainly hope so. I'm getting antsy, to be quite honest with you.
Oh, it's coming. It's going to be really, really good. Okay, well, that's it. Long-term trends, financial economy and financial markets and geopolitics. Before we close part one, any more thoughts on sort of that aspect of news, trends, and stories for the second quarter? Was this the most intense quarter you've had so far?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, it started out intense, but in the last 3 to 2 weeks, it's just like it went off the charts.
Right.
It just went up like a bottle rocket. And, you know, I felt like, my word, there's absolutely no way any individual can keep track of all of this. And you know, I'm very grateful to the people on my website that keep sending me all these articles, because I get a very, very different picture than I would be getting if I were to try and research things all on my own or watch television news or what have you. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think being an intelligent network or being, protecting and enforcing the Constitution, we need a way to do this that where we're doing it together. It's all of us. We're a learning network, and
yep,
it's gonna be, no one person can do it, and we're just gonna have to do it together. Why I always have this Larry report with, don't ask if there's a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one.
Start one. That's right.
That's right. We're in one. Okay. Well, part two coming up next week, and Joseph, I can't thank you enough.
All right. Thanks for having me back on, Catherine.